Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Tyler Kendall here in Washington alongside Joe Matthew, where we are inching closer, it appears, to reopening the government after a record-long closure. But while the Senate has passed this bill on a procedural basis, there's still a lot more that needs to get done before we see final passage. And as House Speaker Mike Johnson outlined earlier, it's definitely not a done deal.
They'll need unanimous consent from all senators to fast-track their final vote. As you know, there are some procedural hurdles that one or more could throw in the way, but we certainly hope that they won't do that because so many people across this country are desperate for the government to reopen. I'm stating the obvious to all my colleagues, Republicans and Democrats in the House, you need to begin right now returning to the Hill. We have to do this as quickly as possible.
That, of course, easier said than done, knowing that we have a travel crisis and air traffic control crackdown in this country. The FAA each day is removing 1% of capacity. It started at 4% Friday, will be at 10% by the end of this week. So just getting back to Washington is going to be part of the story here. If the timeline holds, from what we understand, we could see a vote as soon as this evening in the Senate. The House would be looking at Wednesday in a best case scenario. But let's talk to Megan Scully about this. She runs our Capitol Influence team. I don't think they ever stopped working all weekend because the Senate never went home. It's great to see you. Happy Monday. There's light at the end of the tunnel, and then we can start talking about the January shutdown. But I'll hold off on that for a minute. Do we expect to see voting tonight in the Senate? How quick can John Thune get this done?
So he needs consent from all 100 senators to move this along. We're expecting some folks, including Senator Rand Paul, who typically holds these things up to do just that, which would then essentially put the brakes on. Mm-hmm. They have to ride out a clock, take another procedural vote, ride out the clock again. So it could be days instead of hours. But this morning, Senator Thune was saying he's hoping it's the hours, measured in hours, not in days.
Mm-hmm. Have we heard from the White House on where they stand on this plan? Because while it would include the stopgap measure, reopen the government, as Joe mentioned, to January 30th, it also appears to have this pullback when it comes to the firing of federal workers, which, of course, is a policy that this White House really championed.
Yeah, so we have not heard anything as of yet from the president himself. We are hearing rumblings from the White House that he is on board with this. Senator Thune said that the compromise had been floated with President Trump last night, and that he expects Trump to sign it if and when it eventually makes it to his desk.
What's it like in the leadership offices right now, for Democrats, that is? Because these eight senators broke ranks, right? Chuck Schumer was still a no, and Hakeem Jeffries just made it pretty clear that he's going to stay a no. They don't like what's going on here, but they've not managed to keep everybody from voting a certain way. There you have on your screen on Bloomberg TV the eight, including Dick Durbin, by the way, in the leadership, who decided to just say, let's get this done. What does this mean for Chuck Schumer now to lose eight votes like this? A lot of folks are calling for him to step down. We hear this type of thing when voting doesn't go a certain way. But how confused is this in the leadership office?
So I think that it's telling, you know, Tyler said it at the top of the hour, that none of these eight are up for re-election next November. That is key here. And to me, indicates that there was some game of chess being played as to who was going to step up and kind of hold their nose and vote for this. Senator Durbin, as you mentioned, is a member of leadership. He is not one you would typically see voting with Republicans on an issue. He is, however, an appropriator, and most importantly, he is retiring. So that makes him a safe vote. I think that that was all built into the calculus here. Of course, Schumer got blasted just months ago when he acquiesced to Republicans and kept the government open back in March amid concerns that Trump was too powerful and too popular at that moment. Yeah. This, though, has been going on for some 41 days, and the calculus is changing, particularly as people go without their food benefits.
So that's the Senate. What are you watching for when this gets over to the House, not just on the Democratic side, but also I'm wondering about House conservatives that weren't able to negotiate some of these spending levels and the bills that are tied to this?
So things like the RIFs, the fired federal workers that you mentioned, some of the spending aspects of this could really cause some consternation, particularly with members of the House Freedom Caucus. We're seeing some tepid support, but that's far from certain at this point. The House majority, the Republican majority, is so narrow that they can only really afford to lose two or three votes and still get this through if Democrats remain united in opposition. What I'll be curious to see is if they lose some Republican votes, if they pick up moderate Democrats. Mm-hmm. Now, Democrats should be having an additional vote when this finally comes up, because the representative-elect Gray Alva from Arizona, who has long been awaiting her swearing in, will likely be sworn in prior to this vote.
Right, and that would make it so that Republicans can only lose two members. Yeah. Of the GOP to get this through. It's always a math game. Megan Yes. Scully, she leads our capital influence team here at Bloomberg News. Thank you, as always. And to extend the conversation, we're going to bring in one of those stakeholders, Congressman Greg Stanton. He's a Democrat representing Arizona's 4th District and also is the former mayor of Phoenix. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us here on Bloomberg. It looks like this package is headed to your chamber later this week. Just to start out, how are you going to vote?
Well, based upon what I know and what I've read about that the agreement contains, I do not plan to support it. You know, we had taken a principled position throughout the shutdown that we desperately want the government to reopen, but we don't want to do it without also ensuring that people have affordable health care. The shutdown happened at the same time that people were receiving their massive increases in premiums under the Affordable Care Act and many other health care entities as well. Coming right on the heels of millions of Americans losing their insurance under the One Big Beautiful Bill. It was an assault on Americans' health care, and that is a critically important fight as well. And my analysis of the agreement doesn't indicate that we're going to be able to say that we've truly supported people's health care and lowering health care costs.
So what just happened here, Congressman? Last Tuesday night was framed as a big win for Democrats. The president was upset about losses that had clearly been inspired by the shutdown. Republicans were seen to be taking the blame. By the end of the week, a jailbreak in the Senate. And I'm curious what you make of the timing here and whether you've heard anything about a vote on these Obamacare subsidies, because every Democrat we've interviewed on this program said the promise of a vote was simply not enough.
Well, the promise of the vote was only on the Senate side. Obviously, the Speaker Johnson Sure. has indicated that he's not going to allow that on our side, so that he was not part of that agreement. That's another big reason why we should not be considering voting in favor of this. We need to ensure that we're going to have a real opportunity to lower health care costs. But let's talk about Tuesday, because the Democrats did win overwhelmingly on Tuesday, particularly in the purple states of New Jersey and Virginia. That wasn't about the shutdown per se. It was about the totality of what the Republicans are doing. These tariffs that are raising costs on the American people, the One Big Beautiful Bill vote that decimated health care for Americans. Mass deportation is unbelievably unpopular. And I think that was a strong statement by those purple states that they are rejecting Trump and they're rejecting MAGA type politics. And we're going to win the majority in next year's election. We're going to win it going away, because as long as these Republicans just keep doing whatever Trump tells them to do, they don't stand up for themselves. They just roll over and allow him to run everything. The American people are saying that's not the kind of politics we want to see in Washington.
But Congressman, if there was a promised vote in the House that mirrors the one that we're expecting in the Senate on extending the Affordable Care Act premium subsidies after the government reopens, would that be enough to get your vote on board now to reopen the government?
Well, it's too early to say that, because we have to know what exactly the vote would be. What would be in the vote? Would it be the Democratic proposal? We want to keep the cost of the Affordable Care Act down permanently. And I know that's a very different viewpoint than the Republicans. So I just think it's too early to answer that, because we don't know what would be in that vote. That wasn't negotiated in this agreement. And that's really a very unfortunate thing.
Congressman, the president on Truth Social is talking about health care and health insurance that's pulling shares of health insurers lower today, saying hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding that goes to what he calls money-sucking health insurers under the ACA should be sent directly to the public. He says he's recommending to Senate Republicans that this money be sent directly to people so they can purchase their own, in his words, much better health care and have money left over. Do you know what he's talking about? And could he do that without Congress?
Of course, we don't know what the president is talking about. And my feeling is, here we go again. The president with his repeal and replace politics as it relates to the Affordable Care Act. As you know, he talked about this incessantly in his first term in office, wanting to repeal it. And then they asked him, well, what would you replace it with? And he had no idea, concepts of a plan or whatever he said. The truth is, the American people support the Affordable Care Act. I was part of the class of 2018 in Congress. We won 41 seats because we ran on protecting and supporting the Affordable Care Act. I cannot believe the president is doing this again. And it's wrong for the American people. It's wrong for healthcare. But politically, it's good for the Democrats because we're again going to be running for Congress and we're going to win overwhelmingly by standing up and defending and supporting the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans would be much better off if they just came to an agreement with us to lower health care costs in America to support the Affordable Care Act. But instead, they keep following Trump off this health care cliff, and he continues with his talk of repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. We don't know what he's talking about, but we do know it's a step in the wrong direction.
But if this is an issue that Democrats do well on, and if this is an issue that requires time to hammer out a deal, I know that you still need to look at what this legislation in front of you this week is going to look like, but why not pass to reopen the government and then use January 30th as the new pressure point so that Democrats can make the conversation about health care and put forward a plan that works and gets agreement to actually enact it for the American people? In the meantime, you have money starting to flow in to alleviate some of those pressure points, like on our air traffic control system and for SNAP food benefit recipients.
Well, we're going to keep fighting to lower healthcare costs for the American people. We want to lower costs overall. We're fighting against these tariffs that are increasing costs for the American people. And we know these decisions of the Republicans, both in the One Big Beautiful Bill and now the decision not to support the Affordable Care Act, not to continue with these tax credits, which make it more affordable. We know how bad it is for the American people. We're going to fight for it now and continue to fight for it. And if it doesn't get done now, we're going to continue to fight for it. This is not a one-off thing or a cynical thing. We believe passionately that we have to lower costs for the American people. And that is why the reason why we took such a strong step in the last few weeks is because people were receiving their premium increases in the mail at that time. So we wanted to make that point that we need to lower health care costs. We need to get the government open. We need to do both. It's not one or the other. And that's the principled position that House Democrats have taken.
I want to ask you about air traffic controllers, because someone like yourself has more than a couple of hours to fly when it's time to get back to Washington this week to vote, I guess, at some point in the coming days. The president is threatening to dock, to use his word, dock the pay of air traffic controllers who took time off, as he puts it, for the Democrat shutdown hoax. Those who did not take time off, he's recommending a bonus of $10,000 per person for what he describes as distinguished service to our country. Does he need Congress to do either of those, or both of those, Congressman?
Yeah, we saw with the whole Doge thing with Elon Musk and him coming in and trying to unilaterally fire a bunch of employees and do it indiscriminately, and then they had to beg these employees to come back because neither Elon Musk nor Doge actually understood what they did. This has echoes of that. Look, all of the air traffic controllers are our heroes, and many of them were not able to work the overtime that they normally worked because they weren't getting paid, so they had to do childcare or some cases had to work a second job in order to have some level of income. Those air traffic controllers are the heroes of this shutdown. In fact, I went so far as to say that I actually supported Secretary Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation, in lowering the number of flights at the 40 busiest airports, because safety of the traveling public has to be the highest highest priority. And these air traffic controllers are committed.
I wish we had more time with you, Congressman. Greg Stanton, safe travels back from Arizona. We'll see you here in the Capitol. I'm Joe Matthew. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Here in Washington, alongside Joe Matthew, where we're tracking any developments around potentially reopening the government, as it seems lawmakers are picking up at least some momentum this week. And it comes as Americans have watched this crisis drag on. We saw consumer sentiment hit a near record low last week, according to a new preliminary reading in November from the University of Michigan. And we have a new data point of our own here at Bloomberg News. A new Harris poll conducted for Bloomberg and released today finds half of respondents in October, Joe Matthew, said the economy wasn't working for them. Mm-hmm. That was up from 41% in February. As we know, there have been a slew of economic policies that have hit Americans so far this year.
And as you can see on the screen, Republicans weigh in differently than Democrats, and it's frequently independents we're looking at in which way they're breaking here. But it does come down to a very similar conversation to the one that we were having on Friday when consumer sentiment, UMich consumer sentiment came out, and the comparisons to the prior administration. Mm-hmm. I'd love to get Jared Bernstein back in here, to be honest with you, to talk about this. You know, do you want to believe me or your lion eyes type of approach where people are not feeling great, but the president is telling them that the economy is better than their experience. This is something that Joe Biden learned a lot about, trying to get prices back down. And the president is still trying to figure out the job. Yeah, I'd say we definitely do it. Let's invite Jared back on to talk about this, because Tyler, it is something that Democrats and Republicans have in common.
Right, exactly. And both administrations have said that it will take time to mm-hmm. see their economic policies work through the economy. I was struck in our story that's on the Bloomberg Terminal about this data. It shows how we've seen Trump administration officials at first say that we would see those results by the fourth quarter. We're now seeing them push out those estimates to next year. And the economy, of course, has been critical for this White House because President Trump's potential handling of the economy was the issue, according to all of our Bloomberg News polling in those critical battleground states that really helped propel him to the White House.
That's true. And this is why we're hearing about it more from Democrats these days in some cases than Republicans. We assembled our political panel for their take on all of this. Bloomberg Politics contributors Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano are with us. Jeannie is Democracy Visiting Fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center. Rick is our Republican strategist and partner at Stone Court Capital. You spoke to this when UMich came out on Friday, Rick, and I guess against the backdrop of what we've seen in the past 24 hours, it's just curious. Democrats outperformed in elections last week. Republicans taking the blame for the shutdown. You add this particular layer here. Republicans are on the ropes when it comes to affordability, specifically as an issue. Why then do these eight Democratic senators turn around and vote yes on the deal? What do you make of the timing?
You know, I think that, look, we're already at the historically longest government shutdown in history. There's an enormous amount of frustration, grinding of gears. We've talked a lot about, you know, the flight situations, but also government employees out of work, not getting paid. There are a lot of pressure on these members of Congress, regardless of what the status of negotiations are, who's getting what out of the deal, to say, you know what, we've had enough of this. Let's get government back open. Let's get these people back working. Let's get the air traffic controllers back in the terminals. And we can beat each other up over policy all day long after that. But I really don't think it's much more than just doing your day job, right? Your day job is not to shut down government. Your day job is to make government work. This first step in that direction. But they do it with the veil of a very grumpy electorate, right? I mean, you know, a lot of the economic progress that's been made under Donald Trump has been made with, you know, wealthier individuals and corporations. And there are a lot of folks feeling totally left behind. Hey, that sounds just like the Biden administration, where they had some economic progress, but they weren't able to translate it down to the working class. And so, you know, this poll that you have really screams out independent voters are grumpy about the economic situation and their future. And the future is really the thing that barks out in this poll, as does the Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. in that even though they might be feeling fine right now, and that is borne out by some macro and microeconomic factors, they think the future is dismal economically, and that is causing a lot of disruption. And we saw some of that disruption last Tuesday with a massive vote for Democrats, a big turnout of voters, and a real disruption in the political system.
Well, Jeannie, let's get your thoughts on how American sentiment is being impacted by this government shutdown. And then also go back to this question on a timeline, which mirrors what Joe was asking Rick, because we know that at the heart of Democrats' demands was that they want to see changes when it comes to health care. But realistically, how long is it going to take to hammer out a deal with Republicans on health care? And could Democrats afford to do that while the government shutdown dragged on?
Yeah, I think these eight folders, as I'm calling them now, Tyler, they decided that they were not going to be able to get there from a policy perspective. And that is in keeping with what we know historically about shutdowns. Shutdowns are never about policy changes or seldom result in policy changes. What they are framing mechanisms for these parties to say, we are the party of X. In the 95-96 shutdown, the GOP was able to say, we are the party of responsible budgeting. We want to deal with the debt. We want to balance the budget. Today, the Democrats can claim the mantle of, we are the party focused on affordability and the health care of Americans and making it cost effective. And that's something they hope to take into 26. That said, it's very hard for Democrats in particular to keep a shutdown going on as long as they have, because, of course, Democrats are a party of government. They want the government to be active. And so to shut it down makes very little sense for most moderate Democrats. And I thought the poll that you're just talking about, the Bloomberg Harris poll, is fascinating because the numbers, Donald Trump's approval, he's under 18% underwater on the economy. And only a third of Americans in this poll saying the economy is on the right track. And what is Donald Trump doing? He's low-flying over football games. He is avoiding every opportunity to talk about the economy. He's sitting in the White House last week, as we talked about, saying affordability is a con job. Well, these are not the words of somebody focused on making the economy right. And this comes on the heels of both Scott Bessent and Kevin Hassett saying that parts of this economy are in recession. So the question here is, at what point does the president take that seriously and the GOP start to address it? The longer they avoid it, the better politically for Democrats going into 26, but the worse for working class and average Americans in the moment and as we go forward.
We just heard from Adelita Grijalva, a name that has been coming up a bit more now that the government appears to be on the threshold of reopening. The representative-elect would be sworn in to take part in this vote. Just out with a statement here from her district in Arizona, quote, I am planning to travel to Washington, she writes, after hearing through Leader Jeffries and media reports that Speaker Johnson finally intends to swear me in. I guess that invitation hasn't come directly. While I'm eager to get to work, she writes, I'm disappointed one of my first votes will be on a bill that does nothing to protect working people from skyrocketing premiums, loss of health coverage, or do anything significant to rein in what she calls Trump's abuse of power. So I guess that's a no. But Rick, I'm curious your thoughts on the president's post here involving the health insurers, because it's moving stocks. You've got Centene, United Health, and others pointed straight down after the president went on Truth Social to say that hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding that goes to money-sucking health insurers under the ACA should be sent directly to the public, he says. People can purchase their own much better health care and have money left over. I'm sure you'll never forget the thumbs down moment with Senator John McCain on the Senate floor. And I know that Donald Trump has not forgotten it either. What do you make of the fact that still at this point, when we consider the idea of concepts of a plan, that Republicans don't have a better idea? The president has not put forth a formal proposal on health care to replace Obamacare. How are we still having this conversation?
Yeah, you know, the president kind of stepped in it again this last week, talking about, well, what we really need to do is not debate, you know, these ACA subsidies, but to actually reform health care in America. And that's a really deep well that gets really dark the further down you go. And the reality is he got asked the right question, which is, well, you've been talking about this for 15 years. What's your plan? And I guess this was, you know, behind the envelope. Hey, I got a plan. You know, don't give the money to insurance companies. Give it to the individuals who, I guess, I mean, unless I'm misreading this, then give it to the insurance companies for health coverage.
Correct.
So, I mean, like, I'm not exactly sure how this Ponzi scheme is supposed to work, but it, I think it's just a reaction to not having a plan. And all the best advisors in the world, you can imagine, he called them in and says, what's my plan? And they're like, hey, we don't have a plan. And he's like, okay, I got to come up with one. And here you go. I don't know. I mean, I think he's trying to deflect some of the incoming that he's gotten on the criticism of the ACA. And by the way, as you pointed out, John McCain went down to the well of the Senate and put his thumb down on what was called at the time skinny reform. It was not reform of ACA. It was a gutting of the ACA and going to leave a lot of people without health care. And so, you know, deja vu all over again, I guess, in the United States Senate and in the White
wow.
House.
Jeannie, we only have about a minute left with you. Healthcare, of course, as Joe and Rick outlined, at the center of this, but also we saw federal workers being fired come to a head during this shutdown. This package would supposedly reverse those federal firings. Is this something that the White House is going to go for when we know that this has really been one of the centerpieces of the agenda while the government's been closed?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, Tyler. I can't imagine Donald Trump would. I have not heard yet whether he supports this, but this is diametrically opposed to everything he and Russ Vogt, and by the way, Elon Musk and Doge have been focused on since he got into office. So maybe they'll have to swallow this as a part of a way to get the government reopened. It seems that Tim Kaine, critical vote here. This was critical for him and coming on board with Republicans to reopen. But I can't imagine that Russ Vogt is looking fondly at this idea or the president.
All right, our political panel today, Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, both Bloomberg Politics contributors. Thanks so much, as always. We're going to turn from domestic politics to foreign policy next, talk about the oil market after some recent sanctions relief. Stick with us. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A risk-off session, to steal a phrase here, and we're even seeing oil prices tick higher. Yeah, WTI, West Texas Intermediate, not a lot, but up about 0.5% to crawl back above $60 a barrel. And the idea here is that the government shutdown is making everybody feel a little bit better about something. This can get to be difficult to quantify in the energy market, though, and that's why we wanted to spend some time with Bob McNally, the founder and president of Rapidan Energy Group. Spent some time in the White House dealing with energy matters as a special assistant senior director for international energy on the National Security Council under President George W. Bush. Bob McNally, welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio. From what we understand here, investors are looking at this a bit differently, at least the settling of prices that you have been forecasting will tip lower here, even lower yet, deepening their bearish stance at this time. Because what, Bob, as you say, it just comes down to barrels, right?
Joe, great to be with you. You know, you're right. The market analysts have been looking over the horizon for signs of this surplus, this tsunami, if you will. Futures curves have been flattening, going into contango. Oil inventories are beginning to rise, especially oil at sea. Now we can track that. Couldn't do that 20 years ago. Now we see it. And so there are incipient indicators that this long expected looseness, oversupply in the market is arriving. And you see oil prices gravitationally, Joe, they want to go lower. They were headed lower fast until President Trump surprised everybody a couple weeks ago by announcing those sanctions on Russia, and they had to have short covering and a sharp little rally in prices. But the gravitational forces, I think, are going to continue to impose themselves. And unless we have a material disruption due to geopolitical risks, I think direction of oil prices is lower.
Well, Bob, I actually wanted to ask you about an exemption to those Russian sanctions. On Friday, the White House announced that Hungary would be granted an exemption. We know that they import a lot of Russian energy supplies. About 90% of Hungary's crude imports come from Moscow. How are you watching that? Is that going to make a dent when it comes to Russia's revenues from barrels reaching the market?
Hi, Tyler. No, it's a real small issue for the global oil market and for Russia's revenues. Look, Hungary is a landlocked country that, as you mentioned, gets just about all its oil and gas from Russia. In the case of oil, from the Druzhba pipeline. I mean, there's just no other options. It can't bring on, you know, oil from the U.S., U.S. tankers and so forth that easily. And so it's about 2% of Russia's export volume and revenue. So it's not a big deal for Russia. I mean, by not forcing Hungary to stop taking Russian oil, the Russians are preserving about 2% of their volume and revenue for exports. But in the grand scheme of thing, it's pretty small. Hungary is very dependent, needed Russia a lot more than Russia needed Hungary. And the president gets along very well with Viktor Orban. So not too surprising that deal was cut.
Yeah, Bob, we're going to hear from OPEC and from the International Energy Agency both on Wednesday, their analysis and outlooks. Will they agree and what will they tell us?
Well, Joe, Wednesday is a very big day for the analyst community, the energy analyst community, because the IEA will issue its annual World Energy Outlook, WEO, we call it. And for the first time in 5 years, that flagship influential forecast will include something investors have not seen, a scenario, a forecast where if we assume current policies in place around the world, oil and gas demand continue rising until 2050. For the last 5 years, the IEA has only issued forecasts that show oil and gas demand peaking around 2030 and then either plateauing or falling. So while we may be talking about a glut up here in the front in the beginning, a couple quarters of next year, what the IEA is going to reveal for folks, again, Rapidan has been of this view for a long time, but is that the medium to long term is looking a lot tighter. Because one thing everyone would agree, Joe, we are not investing enough in oil to supply a world in which demand keeps growing after 2030, as the IEA for the first time says it might, instead of peaking by then. So very big day for the world energy community and the IEA on Wednesday.
Bob, in the final minute we have you, what is the foremost geopolitical risk when it comes to the Middle East and the oil markets? Because today, for example, we have the Syrian president meeting with President Trump at the White House.
You know, the biggest risk remains Iran. There was an excellent Stephen Erlanger, a New York Times report the other day, end of last week, I think, pointing out something we've been advising clients for a while. It's not over. We had the June war, and then people aren't paying attention anymore. But Iran is reconstituting its nuclear weapons systems and its other means of terrorism. And Israel is not in the mood to allow that to continue. And I think if you ask me what is the biggest risk, it is that we have a flare-up again of military conflict in the Gulf, and that unlike June, Iran or others start targeting major Gulf infrastructure. The lion's share of oil and gas production exports is still in that region. It's not over with Iran, so that's the one that I think I would worry about much more than what's happening in Syria or even Iraq.
All right, Bob McNally, founder and president of the Rapidan Energy Group. Thank you so much for joining us, as always, here on Bloomberg Television and Radio. We didn't get into this part of the conversation, but we know that President Trump has had his sights set when it comes to lowering energy costs, and it appears that the administration is taking aim at another high cost for consumers when it comes to the price of the food industry, in particular consumer beef prices, which have jumped 16% this year, according to the USDA. Tyson's Foods today saying it expects profits to be little changed next year as beef continues to lose money for the company. And now President Trump is directing his Department of Justice to look into allegedly driving up prices when it comes to the meatpacking industry. To unpack all of this, we're joined now by Doug Farrar, principal at Maywood Strategies and former senior advisor to FTC Commissioner Lina Khan. Doug, it's good to see you and thanks for coming in. Can you just walk us through this? The Trump administration is now trying to launch an investigation, which sounds sounds similar to some of the investigations that we saw launched under the last administration. How feasible is this for an investigation like this to get off the ground?
Well, thanks for having me on. So it's going to be tough. They cut staff quite a bit. Obviously, we know about DOJ. A lot of staff have left the FTC and the DOJ. And when you run functionally a law firm and you take on some of these major investigations, you need a ton of bodies. You need a ton of really sharp lawyers, subject matter experts to really make a case. And this market is definitely one worth looking at. So I think it'll be a challenge, and we'll see if they have the attention span to see it through and the staff to really make a difference.
I need to ask you about what's going on at the FTC, not that you're there any longer, with regard to Pfizer. This story today is remarkable, and Pfizer is a mover because of this. Albert Bourla learned that the board at Metsera had voted unanimously to accept Pfizer's takeover offer, which it was competing with Novo and had been some other companies. Turns out the FTC picked up the phone and called Metsera to warn the company that it would look unfavorably on the corporate structure that would have been included under the Novo deal. And just like that, we've got a merger Monday. Is that legal?
Well, I'm not following it as close as you are, as you said, but I know that the agency said they weren't granting early terminations during the shutdown period, and they've obviously gone back on that. And so I think that that's an interesting data point to look at as you consider what's going on at the FTC right now and how they're examining mergers. But yeah, it's a complicated
case. To what extent, though, is the agency allowed to actually get involved on a direct level like that with a proposed deal?
Typically, agencies don't get involved at a proposal level. It's once an HSR filing's been made, a merger's been announced. Certainly, the agency staff are in communication with firms, for instance, who are thinking about merging in order to ask them to preserve documents and do so, the things like that. But yeah, in general, it's pretty unusual.
A lot of this is coming down to this idea of antitrust going up against big companies. We're seeing affordability really come to the forefront, particularly after Tuesday's recent elections. I'm wondering how you're watching this administration navigate that issue. We saw Democrats come off with a win, but now we have President Trump and the administration announcing some of these initiatives that are geared towards, they say, lowering prices and breaking up competitiveness.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, he campaigned on breaking up big tech monopolies, on being a sort of fire-breathing populist. And since then, he's come in and he's been incredibly friendly to business. If you look at his AI EO, for instance, he's essentially instructing the FTC to be a concierge for AI companies seeking to roll up the market. You know, so this is a big shift, and I do think it's driven by politics. You know, the attention span of this administration is not long, and in order to really make an affordability agenda based on antitrust enforcement, for instance, you have to find good cases, bring them to court, win on appeal, and it takes a lot of work, and they've lost a lot of staff, and it takes a lot of attention, and it makes a lot of people mad. And you go back to the meatpacking industry, you know, some of the meatpacking executives have incredibly cozy relationships with the president. So if he decides he really wants to go after them, is he going to get an angry phone call? Is that going to change things? You know, maybe there's a donation to the ballroom. Who knows? It's kind of an open question.
Interesting. You know, you look at the likes of Goldman Sachs, listen to what David Solomon is saying about the pipeline right now. We heard a lot about animal spirits when this president went back into the White House. Is that coming to fruition? Are you seeing the pipeline filled in a way that people expected?
I think in the initial phase, people took the rhetoric seriously, right? Yeah. I mean, you had Ferguson Slater, you had President Trump and others, Vance, talk about how they wanted to do a lot of enforcement. But there hasn't been a lot of enforcement, and to the degree there has been, it's been kind of odd, with certain merger settlements being a little unusual, very political, outside of the realm of what's normally done in antitrust. So, you know, I don't know whether that'll lead to a merger wave or not, but certainly it doesn't seem like the agencies are going to be as active as they were under President Biden.
A lot of this administration's policies have to do with bolstering domestic manufacturing, protecting U.S. companies. In President Trump's post, when it came to the meatpackers, he wrote about cracking down on majority foreign-owned companies that are driving up prices, according to him. In your experience, how much is this about combating international companies versus domestically owned ones?
It's a good question, and I think it's very market-specific. You know, the meatpackers import a lot of meat from abroad. It's countries like Canada, countries further afield like Nigeria, Brazil, and what I think a lot of the ranchers want is country of origin labeling. You know, we're in a MAHA moment, right? People want to know what they're eating and where it came from. And American ranchers feel, I think rightly, that if people knew it was American beef, they might even pay more for it. That would empower them to have a more profitable business and fight back against the consolidation of the packers. So I think there's some stuff that they can do on this.
Well, Doug, we should mention the fact that at Maywood Strategies, this is day one, right? You're just getting your new firm off the ground.
That's right. Day one. I'm looking forward to working with clients, looking across regulatory and political
strategies. Well, it's interesting to have you on the other side of the glass here. So thank you for coming.
It's great to be here.
To talk to us. And life after the administration, I guess, is the story here.
Indeed.
Doug, thank you so much. Maywood Strategies, former senior advisor to FTC Commissioner Lina Khan. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington alongside Tyler Kendall. And we've got a whole other round here, Tyler. We likely will know more by 5 p.m. when we join you for the late edition of Balance of Power. Whether we're going to see a Senate vote this evening, it is entirely likely that we will, which will then start the clock on a House vote. They'll have 36 hours to get everybody back in town.
Right, exactly. And keep in mind, House Speaker Mike Johnson still has his work cut out for him, right? Our understanding is probably lose two Republicans, and he doesn't have them all.
That's true. We're still counting votes here, even after what took place last evening in the Senate. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.